Well, good evening. You don't know who I am, and I don't know many of you, so I'm kind of the surprise preacher, I guess. I know the Matheson family, and the Mathesons themselves, and then the son and daughters, and we all knew each other up in Alaska, so that's the connection, okay? So, and we have a lot of good memories together, and look forward to going over some of those more if we have time later. I've been a preacher for 25 years up in Seattle. Now I am at Seattle. Been in Alaska for 9 years, Seattle for the last 16 years. So one of the things we do in preaching school that I do teach is we go over verses and we learn from them. And we go over verses in such a way that is different than you might be used to going over verses, instead of just studying a verse and saying, well, this is what that means to me, or that's what we've always come to know it as. We just look at verses that may not say what you want it to say, but will say what the truth is. So when we read verses over and over, sometimes the familiarity with those verses blurs the meaning. We think we hear what it says or something like that. Ephesians chapter 1, verse 7, for example, says, in him we have redemption through his blood. There's a lot packed into that phrase. In him, we, certain people, have, certain verb usage there. Redemption, which is a huge subject, through, in other words, in the process of, or through the process of, his blood. We start looking at each one of those things independently. Well, you've got a sermon right there. More importantly, you have a Bible study. You're studying really what the Bible teaches rather than simply what the standard position, if you will, or standard teaching has been on that. I call this little thing observe and report. And it's something we use, again, in preacher training for preachers to learn how to study their Bible. You can use this, too. Turn with me to John chapter 14, verse 15. There's a short little verse that you've probably read many times, maybe dozens of times, maybe 100 times for all I know. And John chapter 14, verse 15, it says, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. I've read that verse a lot of times. That's simple form, simple words, simple expression, yet it's very deeply profound. And it affects every single person. It affects every single person, that verse does. It's spoken by Jesus to his disciples in the upper room. The occasion, of course, is the Last Supper. It's the final discourse that he has with his disciples before his arrest. John chapter 13 through 17, nearly one quarter of John, the book of John, is Jesus' intimate, revealing, and very important instruction to those men. I'm not suggesting you've never taken time to dwell on what Jesus says to them here. I'm not suggesting that at all. Yet probably not everyone has. So this lesson is taking each word from Jesus' statement so that we can properly more rewardingly appreciate the solemn impact that all this has on our lives. That word if is a big word, and it immediately sets a certain context here. The if-then statement. The if-then premise. If this, then that. So there's a conditional statement being made here. Jesus is making a condition to our love for him, and that is by keeping his commandments. So there's a premise, which is a foundational idea, and then there's a promise. And so we see these things in Jesus' ministry. I'll give you some examples of other places where this is found. In Matthew 6, 14 and 15, he says, for if you forgive others of their transgressions, your Father will forgive you. If you don't, well, then he won't either. So there's that if-then construction, that conditional statement, basically saying that if you want what God has, then you have to do what God says to do. And so it's just very simple to see that. We have the premise as well as the promise. Here's another one, Matthew 12, verse 28. Jesus says, but if I cast out demons by the Spirit of God, then the kingdom of God has come upon you. Well, what if he couldn't cast out demons? Well, then the kingdom of God hasn't come upon them. And what if he said the kingdom of God came upon them, but he wasn't casting out spirits? Well, you see what happens here. The whole thing breaks down. So the if-then clause or the if-then condition here makes the whole thing work only if everything is met. Here's another one, but this is in the reverse order. Now we have the promise first and then the premise. Jesus says to his disciples in Matthew 16, 24, if anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. So those last three things, take up his, deny himself, take up his cross, follow me, is what he's asking of us if we want to follow after him. So the conditions have to be met. No one can say that he follows after Jesus who refuses those conditions. If you reject the premise, you reject also the promise. You reject the offer that is being made there. John chapter 14, verse 15, we see it again, but again, it's in the reverse order. If you love me, you will keep my commandments. So that same reverse construction, keep my commandments is the premise. Love me is the promise. And it's not Jesus making the promise to us. The wording is that we are making the promise to him. We are making the promise to Jesus. We agree, we comply, or we don't. And the opposite is also true. If you don't keep the commandments, well, then you don't love him, no matter what you say. And there's a lot of that going on in the world. I don't know if it's happening in Georgia, but certainly happening in Washington, where I'm at. You know, a lot of people saying they love Jesus, but they're not keeping his commandments. So they don't really love him in the way that he requires of them, unless, of course, they meet that premise. And the next word Jesus says in that statement is the word you, which you might not think is a big deal, except that that makes it very personal. Jesus doesn't say you all, or y'all, or all y'all, right? I've been learning. And so he doesn't say your congregation, and he doesn't say Christians everywhere. He's not saying a generic, general statement. A lot of times we do that. We generic the context there. I know that's not a right way to say that, but using it as a verb, but that's kind of what we're doing. We make it generic. We like to talk about the we thing, hey, we all do this, or we should do that, or we should do this other thing. And what we're really saying is you all should do that, but I don't necessarily have to. But I'd like to be included in the we when it's successful. Jesus doesn't talk like that. He says you. He's talking to you, whoever you are. You are the one who's hearing him. You are the one who's reading this. You are the one who perhaps is considering to become a Christian. You are the one who is a Christian. So Jesus is not laying down the terms and conditions for the church here as a collective entity. He's laying down the conditions for each individual person who comes to him and says, I want to be your disciple. Jesus says in so many words, that's excellent. That's a great idea. That's a great resolve. But here's the deal. This has to be met. Each one of you has to meet that. And what that means then is you cannot love or keep commandments by proxy, by a third-party arrangement, by a separate agency. I know sometimes I've met this so many times where you have, typically, unfortunately, a weak husband and a very strong, faithful wife. And the husband thinks that somehow he's going to ride the coattails of his wife's faithfulness into heaven. So he is not that committed. He's not that all in. He's not that convinced or whatever it might be, but she is. But he's there by association. And that's not what Jesus is talking about. God doesn't save marriages. He saves individual people. He's not saving churches. He's saving individual people. So this is very popular today, people thinking that righteousness and faithfulness and love for Jesus can only be is there only because it's associated with someone who does actually love him and follow him and is faithful to him. There's this other word here, which is powerful, of course, the word love. It comes from the root word for the love word that we have, agape, Greek for love here. And that love means to serve the best interests of the other person, whoever they are, and at a sacrifice to yourself. There's a loss that you incur. There's a selflessness to that. Actually, the Greeks have five words for love, and four of them are used in the Bible. One is not. Now, there's a phileo love, the friendship love. There's a philadelphia, which is brotherly love. Eros, which is sexual love, which is the one that's not in the Bible. There is storge, which is in the Bible only in the negative, astorge, which means the lack of love for family, but it literally means family love. And then there's agape love, that selfless, serving, sacrificial love that Jesus is talking about here. So Jesus isn't talking about those other kinds of love. He's talking about that specific one. 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 4 through 7, we find there, I'm not going to go through all that. You probably have heard lessons, maybe even series of lessons on this. You know, all the different aspects or attributes of love. Love is patient, kind, not jealous, not boastful, arrogant or becoming, doesn't seek its own agenda, and so on. So those are the qualities or the virtues of love. And that's the kind of love that he's talking about. So Jesus defines the love that he wants in the context of his gospel. What that means then is when he says, if you love me, he's not asking you to love him in the way that you choose to love him. He's telling you to love him in the way that needs to be, that you need to love him, the way that needs to happen, the way that he has shown you to do. He's setting the parameters. He's setting down the definitions. He's defining the terms for you in his word. So he's not leaving it up to me to decide how to love Jesus on my own, in my own way, according to my own preference, according to my own expectations. In the context of this upper room discourse with his disciples, it says it on his terms, and he shows himself to be the example. In fact, we'll look at that right now. In John chapter 13, verse 34 and 35, later on he says, before our passage, he says, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, even as I have loved you. He doesn't say just love one another. If he had just left it at that, then we could just love everyone however we choose to. But he gives a certain modifier. He qualifies his statement by saying, this is the how to do this. This is how I want you to love. And by this, when you do that, all men will know that you're my disciples if, there's that condition, if you have love for one another. So as I have loved you, it becomes that point of reference, the defining essence of that love. And then there's that word me. You think, well, that's a duh, okay, right? Because that obviously means Jesus, and we know that. Well, just as Jesus made it personal for you when he said, if you, now he's making it personal about himself. If you love me, is what he's saying here. He doesn't say, if you love the church, or if you love religion, or if you love singing, or if you love Christianity. He says, if you love Jesus. So our deepest, most sacrificial, most sacred love cannot be given to our spouses, to our children, to our family members, or even to the church. That belongs to Jesus. I just got done saying in a series of lessons I did down in Albany, Georgia, here this last weekend, we were talking about this very point here, and I asked the audience, I says, has God ever asked you to love your husband or your wife with all your heart and your soul and your mind? The answer is no. He's never told you to love your children that way. He's never told you to love me that way. He's never told me to love you that way. He's told all of us to love him that way. God is a divine being. He is transcendent of us. He is above us in every respect. He deserves a greater love than we give to one another. And we don't always get that. Sometimes we say, well, I love God, but I also love my mom and dad, and I love my kids. And we kind of put everyone on the same page, on par with each other. And that's just not worthy of a divine being. God deserves better than that. And Jesus is telling you, in so many words, that he deserves better than that because he is a divine being. So he's the one who died for us. He's the one who was raised for us. He's the one who lives for us. Your family members, your husband, your wife, your children, your friends, all those other people, they did not do that for you. They could never do that for you. And even if they did die for you, they couldn't save you in that death. So it's really important that we understand the me here that he's talking about. Luke chapter 14 and verse 26, he says, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brother and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. That's another if-then statement. And that means that there's a premise and then a promise. If you want to be his disciple, you have to fulfill the premise. If you want the promise of being his disciple, the premise has to be fulfilled, and you are the one to do so. Obviously, he's not talking about literally hating your mother and father and so on, but rather he's talking about a matter of choice, a matter of allegiance, and a matter of priority. Again, he calls us to love him more than any other person, any other thing, any other pursuit. And quite frankly, if you don't love him that way, then he is not your Lord. Something else is. He's not going to share the billing with someone else. You can't serve two masters equally. Jesus said that too in Matthew 6:24. So if you want to be his disciple, there's something you have to do. There's a kind of love you have to give to him. All right, so far in this first part, what we've talked about, the first part of this statement here, John 14, verse 15, this is what we need to prove. We need to prove our love. This is not unfair. This is not unexpected as a request from him. We have no reason to believe God's love until he proved it. God could tell us he loved us all day long. He could tell us he loved us, you know, dearly and fervently and passionately and so on. He could use all the adverbs that he wanted to. But until he actually showed us that he loved us, that love doesn't really exist. And the same thing with yours, with your love. If you talk to God and tell him how much you love him, that's good. But ultimately, action is required. Imagine a husband telling his wife, "I love you." Well, that's a good thing to say, and that's expected. But ultimately, that husband's going to have to perform in such a way that demonstrates that love. He can't just use words. I know you all know that, because we do that in our relationships. But that also needs to be understood as part of this premise and promise, this conditional statement here. So the second part of the statement has to do with how we need to prove that love. We need to love him. He's told us that. But now we need to prove how. While it's not the only thing required, it's still required. It's kind of like talking about baptism. Baptism is necessary for salvation, but it's certainly not the only thing required. Sometimes we get hung up on that. That's the only thing we focus on. But that's not the right way to look at that. It's just an act of faith, like other acts of faith that are required. So if a person refuses to fulfill the how here, then he's unable to confirm the what. So all of this has to work together, is what I'm saying. Otherwise, it'll be like we see in Matthew 7:23, where he says, "Yeah, you talked a good talk, but I never knew you. You said that you belonged to me. You said that you did all these great things for me, but you didn't do what I asked you to do." So let's look at the last half of this. We looked at "if you love me," and now we'll see the "you will keep my commandments" part of that. And so now we come to that word "you" once again. And you're saying, "Well, we already covered that." Okay, so I'm not going to cover it for very long. So it's you, it's the same person as before. We're not talking about your spouse, someone else, Christians in general, or the brotherhood. We're still talking about you. And just as you cannot allow others to love Jesus in your place, on your behalf, so you cannot allow someone else to do commandments in your place, on your behalf. You have to do that. Jesus, not the Church of Christ, or churches of Christ for that matter, requires personal responsibility, personal love, personal obedience. There is no other way, and there are no exceptions. It just helps. I hope that you see for yourself that when you start looking at it this way, it starts to clarify exactly where you stand, and where at least where you need to stand, if indeed you want the promise. Then there's that that word "will." Well, that's a verb. That's an active verb. Something has to actually be done. Can't just be a good idea or a good intention. Someone can't say, for example, "Well, I would keep your commandments," or "I might keep your commandments," or "Maybe I'll keep your commandments." You actually have to keep his commandments. It's like when Christians talk about suffering, you know, we're told that Christians should suffer, and someone says, "Well, I'm willing to suffer." Willing to suffer and actually suffering aren't necessarily the same thing. Willing says, "Yeah, I've got a good intention to do so if the time and opportunity arises." But actually taking on that which causes the suffering, that's a different story. And that's another lesson. But whatever he is asking can't be ignored. It can't be avoided. It can't be circumvented. For the love to be real, the obedience has to be real. For your love to be real, your obedience has to be real. And then there's that word "keep." In the context here, it has to do with honoring or conforming to what has been promised. And also it has to do with preserving or maintaining that promise as a promise. In other words, it's in constant motion. You have to keep those commandments. They have to be not only kept once, they have to constantly be kept. It's an ongoing thing. So the commandments aren't something that I just read or think or discuss in a class or expound upon in a sermon. It has to be something that I actually perform as a means of fulfilling that promise of love for Jesus. And let me just say, too, Jesus wants you to do these things. He wants you to do this because he wants you to be with him. So he's not just saying this, you know, kind of off the cuff, like, "Well, if you want to follow me, I guess this is what you should do," you know, in some kind of casual way. He's actually saying, I want you with me, but there are some things that you have to do in order to be with me. This thing has to be done. These things have to be kept. In John chapter 15, verse 10, probably just a page away for you. He says there, if you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. Another if-then statement. And so you see that Jesus is not saying, I want you to do something that I've never done. Quite the opposite. He's saying, I want you to do what I also am doing for my Father. I want you to do for me. I need you to do for me what I have done for my Father. You can't do it to the level that Jesus did that. I can't either. But we can certainly have the intention to strive for that and certainly put forth the effort to fulfill that to the best of our ability. Then there's this word, my, which has to do with a personal ownership of these commandments. The word my means that Jesus is the source of these commandments' legal and moral authority. What I'm saying there is he has the right to require these. He's not just saying, I need you to keep certain commandments. He's not saying, I need you to keep commandments that other men have come up with. He's not saying there are commandments out there in the world somewhere that you probably need to keep. He's saying you need to keep my commandments. I own these commandments. I am the personal authority behind these commandments. These commandments come from me, and I will hold you accountable to those commandments as well. So he has the right to do so, which also means that Jesus is not interested in commandments of mere men. He's not interested in man-made religion, and he's not interested in human authority. Just as Jesus' kingdom is not of this world, we're told that in John 18:36. So his authority also is transcendent of all human and earthly authority. All I mean by that is that his authority is above us all. Doesn't matter how powerful you are, you're still human, and you're still on this earth, and you're no better, in essence, than anyone else. You are not a divine being. Jesus is a divine being. His authority is greater than yours, greater than mine, greater than all of ours even put together. What that also means is that we cannot impose human authority on par with divine or heavenly authority. We can't blend human commandments together with divine commandments and come up with a legitimate gospel. And we're talking about a gospel that determines fellowship with God, so this becomes very important. What I'm saying then is that we can't take God's commandments, Jesus' commandments here, and say, well, these are the ones that we really like. These are the ones that we find favorable or that meet our expectations. And then we're going to add a few to those, or maybe we're going to take a few out and we come up with something different in the end. There's no right to do that. Who are we to do that? We have no authority. We're just mortal beings, after all. We're the ones in the need of salvation. Jesus is not. He's the one who is the divine being giving us these things so that we can be saved. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 23, Paul says very succinctly, he says, you were bought with a price. Do not become slaves of men. If we are in Christ, then you only need to obey Christ. You don't have to obey me as if I had some authority, as if my commandments were to do anything for your soul. By the way, I don't have any commandments for you. I'm just saying if I did, okay? He is the one that we answer to. Many people and all man-made religion operate on this little thing that you see on the screen right now. And I hope you can see it on the screen right now, okay? So there is a person who wants to come to God, and that person typically has to go through someone else's approval. A human agency. That human agency can be a person, it can be a church, it can be a board of directors, it can be a tradition, it can be a teaching. Whatever it is, it came from us, or it is us. So people have to go and find approval from human authority or a human agency in order to get to God. Has anyone ever heard this before? This would be a time to put your hands up if you have, okay? So I know that you're really engaged. So think about that. This happens even in churches of Christ, where we are the ones who, you know, we think people have to answer to us. Your baptism has to conform to, you know, a baptism that we expect. Your church service, it has to conform to the church service that we expect. Your name that you use, the things that you believe in, the things that you don't believe in, it all has to conform to us so that you can be right with God. We do the same thing, even unconsciously or even traditionally. We don't want to do that because we don't have authority to do that. Christ is the one that we answer to. And I'm not saying that there aren't traditions and expectations within congregations that are legitimate. I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying here is that Christ is the one we answer to with regard to our salvation. Because remember, I can't save you, and you can't save me. So why would you listen to me? And why would I listen to you when it comes down to that matter? Then he uses that word, commandments. And that is the authoritative requirement, the divine prescription. We're told in 2 Peter 1:3, you're probably familiar with the verse, it says that God has given us everything pertaining to life and godliness. Everything we need to know to have life and to be godly. He's given us those instructions, that prescription. So Christ did not give commandments to burden us, to harm us, or destroy us. He gave us commandments to show us how to walk with God, so that one day we could be with God, because that is the objective. The objective of the truth, the objective of Christ's gospel, always leads to one thing, and that is to bring you to God in His favor. And so that implies then that this commandment, or these commandments, cannot be discovered simply by human knowledge or human intuition, but God has to reveal them to us. And if God hadn't revealed them to us, then there's no way on the earth that we could know them. If you took the Bible out of your memory, out of your knowledge base, and you had no knowledge of this Bible, and you started thinking about, hey, there is a God, an all-powerful, all-knowing being. I don't know anything else about Him because He hasn't revealed Himself to me. But I do know that He exists, and I'm going to have to stand before Him someday. At least my intuition tells me that there's more to this life than this, than what's going on right here. There's more to me, more to my existence. You wouldn't know how to prepare for that. You wouldn't have a clue what to do unless, of course, He told you. Everything we know about the spiritual realm, everything we know about God, our soul, sin, heaven, hell, angels, anything in the spiritual realm, we learned it from God. So this Bible becomes extremely important, and the commandments are extremely important because Jesus says, these are the things I need you to keep if you really love me. Someone says, well, which ones? Well, good question. I'm just going to say all of them. Okay, because who are we to decide which ones we should or should not keep? It's not like Jesus is throwing them out there like a multiple choice, you know, like going to the deli or something. You've got a menu of things, and I'll have that one with the deli mustard and the tomatoes and the pastrami, and you come up with a sandwich of your liking. That's not what this is all about whatsoever. Jesus says, here's the commandments, and which ones do you keep? You keep all of them. In fact, Jesus even says in Matthew 23, verse 23, he's observing that these Pharisees, they observed some commandments and they neglected others. And what he ends up with is he says, you should have done them all. You tithed mint and dill and cumin and, you know, basically these tiny little herbs, which is fine. That's what the law teaches. But you neglected these other weightier things, justice, mercy, and faithfulness. He says all of them were commandments, but you picked and chose. Chose. So that is something that we cannot do ourselves. We cannot pick and choose which commandments we're going to obey. Commandments are meant to be obeyed, not interpreted. Think about that. Commandments are given to be obeyed, not discussed in Bible class. Commandments are given to be obeyed, not hashed out and wonder if we can, you know, massage this a little bit to more to our liking. They're just to be obeyed, period. 1 John chapter 2, verse 3 through 5, it says, by this we know that we have come to know Him, if we keep His commandments. The one who says, I have come to know Him and does not keep His commandments is a liar, and the truth is not in him. But whoever keeps His word, in him the love of God has truly been perfected. Well, there's a big hearkening conditional statement, right? There's a big one right there, and there's some things that have to be met. But John just lays it out, black and white. Just there's no gray area whatsoever. This is how it is. And that's what we need, honestly. We need plain English. Our love for God is not determined by words alone. You know that it's determined also by actions that are consistent with our profession of faith. And it cannot be otherwise. There are no exceptions. No one can claim special circumstances. People do, by the way, but they really can't justifiably. Because no one has any special circumstances that prevent them from doing what God asked them to do to be in a right relationship with Him. And while all this might be difficult, because it is, it's still within the reach and the ability of every single person to do. Once again, John 14:15, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. Jesus is not saying this to threaten us or scare us away. He's saying this to establish the terms of the relationship that He wants with us up front. I find this extremely valuable, helpful, and providing amazing clarity, because now I know what's expected of me. There's no misunderstanding. There's no uncertainty. I know where I stand, however I choose. If I don't keep His commandments, I know where I stand. I don't love Him, and therefore I will not be with Him. But if I do keep His commandments, then that proves my love for Him, and I know that good things await me. I know exactly where I stand, and so it is for you. You know exactly where you stand with God, because Jesus just lays it all out. Someone says, well, what's He doing for me? That's a fair question. This particular verse doesn't say right here, but the rest of the gospel does say that He will be everything you need Him to be. The word being that we're focusing on there is need. Not want, but need. He will be everything you need Him to be. He will be your Redeemer. He will be your Savior. He will be your example. He will be your mentor, your advocate, your friend. So Jesus isn't saying, do it right or else. What He's really saying in so many words is, I don't want to lose you. So I'm asking you to do the right thing. And here it is, the right thing. Do this and you will live. So that begs a question then. Well, what about you? Do you love Jesus? I'm certain most people would say, of course I love Jesus. Maybe someone would be offended that I even asked the question. Now, why would I be here if I didn't love Jesus? Well, the proof is not in your words. The proof is not in you being here. The proof is not in your heart. The proof is not in your feelings. The proof is not in your church going. The real proof is in your listening to and obeying the Master in whatever He says to do. Because He is the one who both defines love and commandments. That's not for you or me to define on our own. So if you've not obeyed the commandments to become a Christian, well, the fact is, you're not a Christian. And I don't say that casually, like it doesn't mean anything to me. It's a bad place to be, to not be a Christian. You can be a Christian, however. In other words, you can change that decision. You can choose to become a Christian. If you claim to love Jesus but have not kept His commandments, you have not proven your love for Him in the way that He requires, and that can all change. So we're not saying prove your love to Jesus to us or to me in person. That's not what's being asked here. Because you don't have to answer to me in the end. You do have to answer to Jesus, so prove your love to Him. That's what He's asking. There's a lot to unpack here, but this is not just a mere exercise in unpacking things. This is really giving us a clearer understanding of what the Master needs us to do. Jesus doesn't say here, I don't want you unless you're perfect. What He does say, though, is, I need you to do this my way, which is the only way. There is only one way. I think I'm offering an invitation here, right? Yes? Jonathan? Okay. Here's my invitation. Follow through with what we just talked about. Do what we just said. Follow Jesus. Listen to what He says. Obey His commandments, and it will go well with you. And again, if you're not a Christian, well then follow the commandments that are necessary to become a Christian. If you are a Christian, continue in the commandments that are required to walk as a faithful Christian. It's really that simple. I realize it's difficult and there's a lot of struggle and so on in there, but the message itself is very simple and straightforward. That is what you need to do. If there's anyone here that needs to do that tonight, this will be the time to respond as we stand and sing the song that has been selected.